Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
6.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dollar Store Dave is here.
I am here.
You're here.
I just got back from the dollar store.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of
so
course.
What did you pick up? How many movies did you get today?
327.
You know, and the thing is that wouldn't make me go, no, he's lying.
You'd believe that.
You have the car full of bags and movies.
Yeah.
And I don't know how your wife can stay there. I don't know.
No. She's my long-suffering wife.
She must drink a lot.
Yes.
Get through the day. You know?
To deal with me. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. Anyway. Well, speaking of crazy, now we've got a returning writer, and he's got a new book out. It's called Descent. And it's a novel based on several true stories. So, Mr. Gary V. Brill, thank you for being here.
Well, thanks again for having me, Al. Dave, it's good to be back.
You got a really good voice. You should be on the radio.
I spent a lot of years talking into microphones on airplanes, so I feel very comfortable doing it.
Were you the guy that wanted to fly since you were like 10 years old?
Five, actually. My dad was a career Army officer, and we used to vacation in Maine for the whole month because you get a month off as an officer. And when I was 5 years old, this guy was barnstorming, hopping rides off a beach in China Lake. And next thing I know, me and my little sisters and brothers jammed in this airplane and were flying around. And from that moment on, I knew exactly what I was going to do with my life.
What is it about flying that that you love so much? Can you pin it down?
Well, there's two aspects to it for me anyway. I always wonder why you wouldn't want to be able to go up and sail around and wheel and turn and dive and swoop like birds do. But the other thing is, you know, I really have always wanted to see the world. I'm an Army brat, as I said, and we moved a lot, but we always had to stay in the States because my dad had a sort of a top secret gig. So all of my friends went to Germany and Japan and all over the place. We didn't, but we moved all over the U.S. So as soon as I could, I hit the road and started seeing the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. Does that keep you into the nomad or transient lifestyle?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I would have 12 changes of address in a couple of years. And there was a name for people like me, I mean, a nice name for people like me, back in the 40s and 50s, and I was what was called a gypsy pilot. I was just available for anybody who had an interesting airplane and a wad of cash.
But that leads to kind of like the stories in this book and the different kinds of people that you run across when you're in that kind of a position or situation.
definitely. It makes some reference to, you know, the general expectation when you tell people you're a pilot. The first question is, oh, what airline did you fly for? And I flew for 30 different companies off over the years. Hustler Magazine was one, the Saudi Royal Family. I did fly for some airlines, Japan Airlines and Evergreen and a couple others, but I wasn't much into the airline thing. If I was, I'd have joined the Air Force or the Navy.
Hustler. Hustler needed people to fly? Like, what were you flying?
Well, it's an interesting story. We were flying a Lockheed Jetstar. It's a little four-engine passenger or executive transport. And it was painted bright pink, and the numbers were 69HM. And the interesting thing is it was Elvis Presley's old airplane. And right now it's up on pylons in front of Graceland.
Can I ask, did you see lots of wild things with that when you were doing that job? Or was it just, it's more a name than anything?
Well, it was mostly moving Mr. Flint or Larry, they always called him, and his family, upper executives. But the wildest thing for me is we'd go to the office. He had like three floors in that big city in L.A., I forget what it's called, the big high-rises. And you go up, and they were doing paste-up on a giant wall with ladders. And it was all being done by grandmothers. I found that pretty weird.
Yeah. Well, you never know what's going on behind that that nice hat. What made you put together this book? Like, what was it that you wanted to tell in this book? Was there a theme to this that you wanted to get to the reader?
No, two things. I wanted to, first off, anybody that I've known since I've been flying says, oh, you got to write these stories down. You got to write these stories down. And it's like, yeah, nobody will believe them anyway. So I just make notes, and I've got logbooks and stuff. I wanted to do that. But I also wanted to explore what happens to somebody when they're really on their way up, when they've been through hell, and they're, you know, they've come out the other side whole, and they're starting to build their dream, and somebody just comes and yanks it out from under them. And, you know, what would be your reaction? I ask people, what would you do if all of a sudden it was all gone in a blink of an eye? You know, what would you do? How would you handle it?
Did you have a problem deciding which stories you wanted to tell?
There's a lot of more boring ones that a lot of pilots might find very interesting. And I go into the minutiae of some of the airplane habits just enough to sort of give people a taste of it without boring them, and also to so the pilots that read it go, oh yeah, that's right, that's exactly right, that's how you do that.
Any stories that you didn't tell?
Oh yeah, about 6,000. But the opening scene where the hero Steve takes the airplane down to wave top height, cruises down the James River at 2 a.m. I did that. I mean, that's straight out of my logbook. That was one of the most beautiful flights. Every word that I wrote about that is absolute fact.
How much literary license do you take with recalling these stories? And do you, or can you be very accurate in what happened in real life?
Oh, I can be real accurate. Some of the stories aren't mine, like the part where the guy comes and chips off the ice into his glass from his airplane and uses it to cool his scotch. That was one of the other pilots. That wasn't me, but it was still, it's a great airmail story, so I had to throw it in there. but I didn't tell the story about my girlfriend and I sort of making out in a Twin Beach one night, and I happened to look out over the window or the sill, and we were directly over Philadelphia Airport at about 4,000 feet, and they must have been going absolutely nuts.
Well, you know, so when you do that, do you sort of change the names to protect the innocent?
Yes.
Well, you can give us some real names.
Yeah. Well, I sort of, the people that were there, and most of us are still alive. We've lost one guy. They'll recognize who I'm talking about.
So what was, for you, what was the pinnacle or the most memorable story that you've come across?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll tell you the story that motivates me. I read this story as a kid and made me want to be a male pilot. And not many young kids want to grow up to be male pilots. But a long time ago, there was a guy named Jack Knight. And he's sort of my hero. And they were starting the Transcontinental Mail. And he was snowed in completely. And if it didn't go, they would look like fools and they would never get funding. So he took off taxiing. in a blinding snowstorm, and he'd come to a fence, and he'd back up a little bit, you know, turn around, take a running jump, jump over the fence, get back on the ground, taxi to the next fence, and he did that all night long. And he got the mail through, and that's how we approached the mail. We didn't stop. I mean, we got the mail through, period.
How do you get that across in your writing? And I mean this in a way of when you're telling the story, how is it that you can make the reader understand kind of like what it is to fly and the need to do what you did?
Well, the one story when Steve is coming into Charleston, West Virginia, which we always call Charlie West, and a lot, that whole sequence of events is also very, very true, something we all experience except for the engine failure. But his willingness to go do that, his drive and determination to attempt it, and then to talk about it later as like, this is no big deal, this is what I do, I'm kind of hoping that set the tone for what this guy's motivation was and everybody else on the mail. I never met a weak dick on the mail, I'll tell you.
You ever wonder where that comes from? Like why you have that in you? Like, is it really that important, the mail?
Actually, no. But our I always felt that my word was, like I said in the book, that Dale, and that was his real name, he's passed away now. He gave us $190 a week in a super cool airplane, and he left us alone. So, you know, I gave him my word I'd fly the mail, and he gave me his word he'd give me money. So we had a good deal.
Yeah. So it's more about something that's inside of you.
Yes.
About when you say the word. It's not really about what you get out of it, like the mail or banking. It's just what you're saying you're going to do.
Yes. And there is a tremendous satisfaction for providing that service and being reliable and having that reputation throughout the community that's a guy there and that's a guy there and that guy over there. They're people that can be relied on. And, you know, when you're 24 or 25 years old, coming up in the business, that means a lot.
Yeah, I'd imagine. What was the hardest thing for you to learn when you were doing that job?
Ooh, not to get the scared out of me.
but how does that happen, right? Because we're human, right?
Yeah.
We all have things.
Well, you have to have absolute faith in the machine, which I did. It was a wonderful airplane. This first airplane that I was talking about, the Navajo, absolutely wonderful airplane. I had confidence in myself. If I couldn't do it, I would turn around and not do it, and I would try again later or something. But I don't know. There was just this sense that we were on a mission, and you had to get the mail through. And it's been, you know, if you look back at even Pony Express days and all that stuff, there was always this, the people on the mail are just different from other people. You go into the sorting building at 2 o'clock in the morning in Baltimore, and those guys, they've got it too. They're in there doing their job, you know, pumping it through, and they're not bitching and moaning about the weather or doing anything.
Well, with flying, do you think you were, for, you know, lack of a better word, addicted to the adrenaline rush?
I'm addicted to going fast, yeah. And I used to fly aerobatics and do air shows when I was 20 in the Hudson River Valley one summer. That was an adrenaline rush. But let me tell you a story about how you have to rely on your instruments. When I was first on the mail, it was a dark and stormy night, of course, and I'd left Richmond heading for Charlie West, and my ears and all the senses in my body told me I was in a 90-degree right bank. Everything, my whole body was screaming at me that I was in a right bank. But the instruments said the wings were level and I was going straight. So for about 10 minutes there, I mean, I wasn't going to listen to my body. That kills you very quickly. I just told myself the instruments were right. They've always been right. Look around. Everything's functioning normally. It's your body that's lying to you. And after a while, that sort of loss of equilibrium and everything settles down and you're good to go.
So Steve Barnes, how do you create that character? Like, how many different people is Steve Barnes?
Oh, about four, maybe five. Yeah.
And who do you use? To create that
Well, I started, I gave him a lot of my motivations and everything, and the impossibly handsome good looks, but
oh, of course,
of course. But you know, I'm not a Vietnam veteran, and I was very cautious about writing about that, putting my hero in that situation, and I didn't pontificate or do anything. I just talked about the experience, get in and get out, and that was based on one of my best friends, a guy that I flew the mail with, Wayne, because he was back from the war. He'd been wounded as a pilot, army pilot, and I never met a more easygoing, down to earth, laid back guy. You know, he just said, well, okay, that was then, this is now, here I am.
So it's kind of an interesting type of personality that does that kind of a job, or has that kind of life, is probably a better way of saying it. When you talk about these pilots, mm-hmm. and how they spend their life, and even yourself, what's the best way that you could describe that to someone that doesn't fly? Like, what kind of person are you?
Yeah, I think my wife's still trying to figure that out. We've been married 32 years. So.
don't tell her.
The one thing, I mean, there's going with the airlines. Of course, the ultimate oxymoron in the whole world is airline security. I've known people that have been hired and furloughed in less than a month. So, and my son just got hired by one of the American commuters, so I'm real happy about that. But I didn't want that. I didn't want to work for a paramilitary, semi-military thing and do, you know, Houston to Dallas six times a day. That just didn't appeal to me. You know, I wanted to go to Egypt. I wanted to fly in Africa. I wanted to see the South Pacific from a cockpit window. And there were times when, I didn't have a lot of money and there was the phone wasn't ringing. And then there were other times where I had to turn down things because I was busy. So it's very hit and miss. So if you're the type of person that can live with that, if you, I mean, the rewards are beyond measure, but the fears, you know, am I doing the right thing? You know, my car's 10 years old. I have $50 in the bank. So, and then the phone rings.
Yeah. Story of my life. No, if when you're watching things like, you know, Top Gun or any of these kind of, wild movies or shows that kind of cover pilots or whether they be in the army or, you know, like the military, I should say, or whether they're just normal flyers or whatever you want to call them, like, and all that stuff. Do you think that they capture them, people that do that kind of thing that you did, very well in most TV and media?
No, not even close. No. You know, when I first started flying, DC-3s, which would be 1977, so I was 25 years old. They said I was the youngest captain in the state, but that didn't mean anything to me. I was just flying the plane that I always dreamed of flying. And a lot of the guys that I flew with, some of them were actually, that ran some of the companies, were actually World War II bomber pilots, and a lot of the guys I flew with were spooks that flew for Air America and things like that. And those guys aren't swaggering, loudmouth, look at me, I'm a macho man kind of people. They just weren't. They were very serious. Oh, they could drink just about anybody under the table. And we had a poker game going in my apartment that they shared with me that went on for about 2 weeks. And you just get up, go fly. You come back about 14 hours later. Somebody else would get up and you take your place. And they were good guys. They were all good guys, but swaggering, you know, big hair, you know, no, I've never known a pilot like that.
Oh, they're not like Tom Cruise?
No.
Well, I guess that's done for a certain audience. They create a character that's really, they don't have to be real. Because it's not that perfect, is it? It's not that perfect, that lifestyle.
No. And I would say that some of the military pilots that I meet occasionally, socially, are absolutely like that. Very swaggering, very full of themselves. But I always found, and this is going to really piss a lot of people off, I didn't like flying with a lot of military pilots because they weren't very good. A lot of guys come out of the military back then anyway with 20 years, 25 years. They got 4,000 hours. I had 4,000 hours when I was 24 years old. But they are convinced that they have the best training in the world, and they don't want to listen to a long-haired hippie kid like me. But I found that sort of thing. But from the newer breed of military pilots, the older guys were the best. I love flying with those guys. I miss them.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you think it's going in a sense of as we keep advancing with, you know, technology and computers and things like that, would a person flying today be, I don't want to say it as good as, but would they be the same type of flyer as you were, let's say?
No. Everything now is, there's a device, a computer device that superimposes itself on the flight instrument. It's called a flight director. And I always found it very distracting. So I used to just turn it off. And it used to annoy people in the cockpit until they got to know me, because that's what they all needed, the flight director to fly them. They couldn't feel, they couldn't take in the information from the instruments, analyze it instantly and react to it. They needed this computer. And I saw that computer when other people were flying it make a lot of terrible mistakes, and people were following it. And this, I had to take the controls away from more than one person when they were following the flight director. It's like, don't do that. Stop that. So, no. Back then, when I was flying, you were taught to fly the wing. You were taught to fly by the seat of your pants and what you felt. And now you're not. You're taught to disregard all that stuff and pay attention to the flight director and the instruments.
Yeah, so it's a lot. You're relying a lot more on systems or computers maintenance, that, you know, than your feel. But you know, but when you were flying, wasn't that they just invented the plane, didn't they? Or
yeah, well, Orville checked me out. So
yeah, I was gonna say, who taught you how to fly? Was it Orville? It's the brothers that taught you how to fly. Yeah. I mean.
But, you know, if you want to talk to pilots, I recommend you go find a grass strip someplace on a Saturday afternoon when the weather's good, or a little short runway someplace, and just go hang out and talk to the people out there, the guys and the gals. Those are pilots. They know how to fly. They were taught properly. And it's when you start flying the bigger airplanes, you lose all of that. Or a lot of people come into the business, never fly those airplanes, and they look down on people that do. They're called flaps. You don't want to know. A few obscenities in there. But the people that say those things don't know anything about flying. I mean, they just don't.
Are there still gypsy pilots like there once were, or is that a thing of the past?
Oh, I imagine there's got to be a few out there. Because there's so much airline hiring, people go towards the security and the boredom. But yeah, I imagine there's still some people out there doing what I did. Yeah.
So you never wanted to do the military flying yourself?
No. I did when I was really out of work and I was married, and I was really just at a real low point in my life. And like I say, I grew up in the Army, and I'm not afraid of the military like a lot of people are. I think I understand it pretty well, the people in it. So I said, you know, I'm going to go join the Warrant Officer Flight Training Program and become a helicopter pilot in the Army. And my wife is like, no, you're not. It's like, sweetheart, I'm not getting any jobs. This is 1972, and there just weren't any jobs around, and the war was winding down. So with a couple thousand hours and all my licenses, I went down to interview, and I'd never mentioned I was a pilot. They gave me the standard Army test, and they came out, and they said something, have you ever flown? I said, yes. I told them, I'm a commercial multi-flight instructor, got 2,000 hours. And they left the room, and then they came back, and they said, we're sorry, but you didn't get a single answer right. And it's like, yeah, okay, I'll see you later. And they said, this is one test we can't give you again. But they said, anything else? You want to go into intelligence, military, police, anything? And it's like, no, thanks. If I can't fly, I'm out the door. And it's just funny. When I was doing the test, they were asking questions and saying, here's the answer. And the answer was wrong. So I gave them the right answer, and they said my right answer was wrong. So that wouldn't have gone well.
That's weird.
Yeah.
What got you into writing and writing about this sort of stuff? Like, why now?
Oh, geez, I've been writing short stories and things since junior high school. I just write for myself. I have notebooks full of.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's J-U-V-E-D-E-R-M.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's J-U-V-E-D-E-R-M.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Stuff that I write late at night when I'm flying or days off or just hanging out. Like I say, this was my first book, actually, that I wrote in, I think, 97, when we were out in Hawaii. I was flying for Japan Airlines. And I don't know, it was just exciting to, because it was all still fresh in my mind and everything. And it's, you know, they say write what you know. So I know a lot about flying. I know a little bit about smuggling drugs. So I mushed them together. And came out with that one. And then the other books, the next one was Driving in Budapest, and we were living in Budapest. And I thought, all these things kept coming to me, these attitudes, these people, these scenarios. And I just started writing, and there they were.
Yeah, when we talk about the drug smuggling and things like that, planes are used a lot in that kind of a business. I know a lot of people, well, not personally, but I've seen it a lot on the news where people have, you know, they've smuggled drugs, let's say, from Canada to the U.S. and back and forth, and it's always done in smaller planes, and mm-hmm. once in a while they get caught, or, you know, they crash, or there's some sort of thing, and you hear about it in the news. So is that still kind of a thing that goes on?
Oh, you bet, yeah. As a matter of fact, in one scene when they're in the hangar in Colombia, and Steve says to the mechanic there that he had flown this type of airplane before, this Lockheed Lodestar, that he had flown it at a jump center up back in the States, and the guy smiled at him. He said, well, maybe it was this airplane. So we did fly a Lockheed Lodestar to a jump center at the New River Valley Airport in Virginia. It's a wonderful airplane. It's a lot of fun to fly. And it disappeared one night, and they found it burned to a crisp down in Georgia. Somebody's stolen it, gone to Columbia, picked up a load, land, they torch it, and run away.
Isn't it hard to do that now? How can you fly a plane and not get caught with drugs? Because don't you have to go through airports and fly over different territories that are monitored by airports and cities and stuff like that? Like, how does this happen?
Well, I imagine it's getting a lot harder. Technology is getting better all the time for spotting stuff. And you have things like look down radar now, which wasn't even a concept back then. So if you get down to 50 feet or something, there's nobody anywhere that's going to see you. But now they do. So this is probably a wrong time to make a career change and get into that business.
Okay. So you're going to retire from that.
Yeah. And I have been approached more than once with very serious offers, and one was actually in a Lockheed Lodestar, and that was also in 1972. And, you know, and
well, how do you handle that?
Well, I said, I'm willing to talk to you about it, sort of like my character Steve does in the book. And I went and had drinks with a guy that drove from New York City in the first DeLorean I'd ever seen. Nice guy, long hair, soft-spoken. And we talked and talked, and I said, you know, I could be maybe talked into doing this once. I'm just saying, I'm not agreeing. I'm just saying maybe. But after that, I'm going on with my career. And he said, no, we need somebody full time. And then I just said, no, I'm not available for that. We finished our drinks. He shook my hand, and that was that.
How do you say no? Isn't it really good money?
Oh, it's extremely good money, but it's pretty big risk.
I mean, because this is the 70s too, right? They barely had radar.
Yeah, and the bad guys keep making that point to Steve. You know, he asked him one night, how much are you going to make flying your mail tonight? And Steve goes, I don't know, $100 or so. And the guy says, I'm offering you $100,000 to do what you do anyway. And Steve says, well, nobody shoots at me anymore. No, I don't want to do that.
Well, it's got to be real tempting, but especially if you're broke, you have no money, and if you do have a wife, or if you have kids or a life, and you're struggling to get work, that must be a real hard thing to say no. Because in a big picture, especially in the 70s, you'd be looking at it, well, drugs are, you know, it's just drugs. Nobody's getting hurt. Like, you know, in your mind, you could say that, mm-hmm. you know.
And I have known a lot of people. Well, I don't want to say a lot, half a dozen or so, that have done it. And I'm not about to rat him out or anything, but one of the guys was killed. There are two brothers down in Southern California that were sort of famous. And he was coming back in a Twin Beach with a load of already bricked up pot into kilos. And he hit a high tension tower in the middle of the desert. And that was the end of him and the airplane and all the dope too. So that's another of the hazards, because you can't show lights or do anything like that. But, you know, those people were usually unable to make a living in aviation any other way. They were kind of has-beens and washed up and outlaws and stuff. So it wasn't surprising.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just interesting. Well, I think it's one of those risks that eventually it's going to end bad somehow, the longer you do something like that.
Sure. And in the long run, you know, it's like the casino, you know, in the long run, they're going to win. And then,
right.
And smuggling, in the long run, you're going to lose.
Yeah, it's you're going to be taken out in an awful way somewhere, mm-hmm. right? It does happen eventually. I mean, That's the way I see it, you know. I go into a casino and I win on a slot machine. I take the money and run.
Yeah. And I always told people, I finished high school and enrolled in college out there, but dropped out in Las Vegas. And I always told people when they asked about the casinos, I said, walk in the front door, stop for 10 seconds and look around at the opulence of this place. They built it with somebody else's money, and they're going to use some of yours to make it even nicer. So don't go in there with anything you're not willing to walk out without, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. Go in with $20 and throw it away.
Yeah. I usually, my limit's $200. I like to shoot craps, so, but I haven't done that in years and years. I did furnish an apartment once, though, but I really haven't done it in a long time, but it's exciting. You talk about an adrenaline rush, man. Everybody's yelling and screaming, having a good time. It's fun.
Jeez, you've lived a life. Boy, excitement, flying, all this drinks with drug dealers, yeah. And
did a little skydiving, gambling, too, but got hurt.
Skydiving. Oh, well. And probably lots of chicks, eh? They all want it to be with a flyer, right? Bad boy.
Well, you know, I'm kind of a, as it says in the book, that part of his character is all me. I'm a quality, not quantity guy. I mean, I married my high school sweetheart. We broke up. I was with Sue for, 7 or 8 years, and she got killed. And then I was with another girl for 8 years, and she sort of went bonkers, and then I got married. So, and in between, there was, you know, some casual stuff, but not a lot. And that's never been my goal, is to sort of notch my holster, so to speak.
That's disappointing.
But I have I've known some really remarkable women, and I've really feel very fortunate in that.
Yeah, well, they were the boss. Yeah. They were. DB Cooper, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, there was a guy who had his act together. That was pretty funny, and he obviously knew that the stairs could be opened in flight, which nobody who wasn't in the business would have the slightest clue. And, and asking for parachutes for the flight attendants, so he knew they wouldn't send up a bad one for him. And then he went. So I don't know. They said they found some of the money a long time ago on some riverbank or something, but we'll see. But after that, it's really funny. I was flying captain on the 727. And you're doing your first walk around with the familiarization stuff. And there's this kind of flopping piece of metal on the back of the left side of the fuselage of the 7-2. And I said, what the hell is that thing? It doesn't look very sturdy. And he goes, that's the DB Cooper switch. And when you take off, this thing fares with the wind and it shuts off the hydraulics to that door. So it cannot be opened in flight. And that's what they call it, the DB Cooper switch.
But what's your thoughts? You've been up a lot, and you've skydived, like you said, and not necessarily successfully. But when you see that, do you think that he did jump and got away just fine, or what kind of, is that kind of possible, or is it not really, or what do you think?
Well, a night jump into the forest like that, with that technology back then, they didn't have the this is what they call square parachutes, the paracommanders and things. So he's probably jumping a round parachute with no control into the woods in the dark. So that was either extremely foolish or extremely gutsy. I'm not sure which. I'd say the chances that he lived and got out of there is probably 50%.
Plus it was bad weather. It was like Thanksgiving, really bad wind and rain. And, I don't know. I'm kind of mixed on it myself, but well, I was hoping you'd say you were D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, we used to fly together, old D.B. and me.
Yeah. You're really D.B. That's the truth.
No, I'm G.V. Or G.B.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. G.B. Cooper. That was just a play on it, you know. So you going to do more stories like this? Are you going to continue this kind of true stories and maybe get into some real wild ones?
I'd like to write a sequel, actually. You know, I've got this journey thing that I'm trying to stay up on. And I've also, you know, I'm an old guy, but I'm getting real busy all of a sudden. I've started this podcast that I do every 10 days. And it's called Gary Talks, too, because my Facebook page is Gary Loves to Write. So Gary Talks, too. And then I started one on YouTube yesterday that I'll do every Wednesday. And it's called Gary Talks Truth. And I'm starting a one-man war on talk radio, on the right-wing propaganda machine that we all call talk radio. So I dropped my first one yesterday, and it's I'll do it every Wednesday, and I just go after the liars and things and people that are spreading crap. And that's different from writing, but believe me, I do a lot of writing with that. It's all on the fly, you know. So,
well, that'll be interesting. You know, there's a lot of bad stuff out there. I mean, you're going to get a lot of haters, of course, mm-hmm. as well, especially YouTube. You'll have to get on TikTok.
Yeah, maybe I should. I don't know. I'd have to do much shorter videos, though. This was the introductory one where I introduced myself, which I won't do. And again, it was about 29 minutes. I'd like to keep it to about 15 to 20. So that's what I'll be aiming for from now on. But I have been, the book ends with Steve turning to the South, obviously going back to Columbia because he said he would. And he's an airmail pilot. And airmail pilots say they do what they say they're going to do. So there's a lot of people in a lot of danger down there. So I could actually, you know, probably write a pretty good thriller and then bring him back into the flying and have him progress, you know, from there. Maybe his world gets better. I don't know. I have to play that one by ear.
Yeah, you could take that place. As, you know, it depends on how much of an imagination you have in creating and developing characters. Characters are really important in a story. Mm-hmm. It's what keeps this books alive, right?
Oh yeah, you have to be relatable. I think everybody. I go to a lot of trouble. The important characters. I mean, the other ones you just sort of a brief description. But you know, like James Woodman in the Journey series and Steve in this Steve Barnes in this series, you really go in depth into the person. So, you know, you feel like you know somebody. And interestingly, I got an agent immediately on my first submission when I sent it out. I still have them somewhere. I got about 7 really lovely handwritten rejection notes, and all of them said exactly the same thing. They said, you have an interesting storytelling technique. There's no good guys in this book.
Yeah.
And that was it. It's like, well, what do you need a good guy? And then Melanie Griffith and her husband at the time, Antonio Banderas, had a little indie studio in Santa Monica, and I got a card from one of them, and it said, would you mind would you hold this for a week before you show it to anybody else? We're going to meet with our staff and see if we can do something with it. And I was like, sure, go ahead. And then I got a note back from them that said, well, there's no good guys.
Well, but, you know, the thing is, if you get into the character enough, because even – nobody is all good and all bad. I mean, that's pretty synthetic. That's pretty, you know, that's the old fashioned, you know, Lone Ranger and, you know, being the good guy and everything he does, everything is great. Then you have the Mr. Evil and that. But the reality is when you're developing characters, even the bad ones or people that do bad things, they do it for a reason. And you're kind of bringing out what about them thinks they're doing something good or right, you know?
Right. Yeah. Not everybody has a white hat. Not everybody's two dimensional. And I think it's hard. I think of Steve as the hero. He's facing these odds, but he does, you know, kill people and smoke dope. So maybe he didn't quite fit their mode of what a good guy was. But I feel like you know this guy by the end of the book. I mean, you actually really understand all his motivations and what's driving him and what kind of a person he is.
Yeah, but I think that's what makes a good character. I think that's what keeps people on the character, too, because there's been a lot of really good characters over the years that don't do all good things, mm-hmm. but you just know them. And you follow them. And I think that's important. I think it's more realistic.
Yeah. And in the Journey series, you know, James, who is clearly a hero to his family and his community, he kills a lot of people too, but they're trying to kill him first. So, yeah. And he doesn't enjoy it. He doesn't relish it. He's defending himself. So that's a bad thing that a good person did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how many bodies have you got now?
Oh, geez, they're stacking up like cordwood. That's all I can say.
how much of yourself do you have to really share about. Like when you write these characters, when you're writing Steve, right, and the good and the bad and the ugly, you know, when you're writing all these things to make the character come alive and have people really, you know, follow this character and know them, you kind of have to expose a lot of your own sort of good, bad, and ugly things as well. How do you manage with that, or how does that change you when you write that?
Well, that's good, Christian. I really do think that there's a little bit of me in most characters, and maybe a lot more in Steve because I'm writing it from my position as an airmail pilot, you know. But there's a little bit of me in James. There's a little bit of me in some other of those characters. And when they're in a situation and their reaction, I got to confess, it's usually how I think I would react in that situation, you know. And that's all you can do. You can't say, gee, I wonder what he would do. I'll just say he did this, because that just doesn't ring true. It's got to feel like that. And, you know, when I finally, because it is a book or a series that's going to cover like 200 years, so people just die. But when James died, I had to go downstairs. I had tears running down my face and take the rest of the day off from writing. You really get wrapped up in these guys, and you really care about them in the story. It's funny. I can't really explain why you feel it so deeply, but you're right. Part of it is probably because there's some of me in James.
Right. So you have to go downstairs and smoke pot.
Yeah. And I do that up in the office, but downstairs. Much colder.
Did you know, did you plan out his death, or was it a surprise to you?
I knew it would have to come sooner or later, and it just seemed when this incident in the forest happened with the capture and everything, it just seemed like this would be the time to do it. He was getting older anyway, and the storm was getting ready to break of the American Civil War, and it was probably just, did I know I was going to do it that day? No, I absolutely did not. But as I was writing, there it was. And that's, you know, again, it sort of took me by surprise. It just came up and it said, yes, of course, that's where this goes. This event has to be in here. So
do you, you're hearing voices when you do this sort of thing?
Well, like I said on our last interview about being a wacky writer, I really do just create these characters and put them in a situation. Then I just stand on the side and listen to what happens and see how they react. And A lot of my motivations and everything will go into those things. Those my feelings and attitudes will go into these interactions. But I really do feel like I'm listening to them. They're helping me write this story. I know that sounds kind of new agey, but that's the way it works for me.
Well, you know, just approach with caution if you get into a plane that Gary's flying. That's all. If he's hearing voices at the time that he's flying.
Well, usually it's through my headset, so don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. That's, you know. That's good. That's really good. Do you ever worry about how people feel when they're going to read these stories? Do you ever think about the reader?
In Descent, because I really don't want my kids to read it. But
oh, you're like Madonna, right? You do these wild things and then have a kid, and then, oh no, you can't watch what I did.
No. And but my oldest daughter has already told me she's going to read it, and she's got a copy. So, and I'm sure the other ones will too. They're 29 and 31. They're old enough to, but I'm not encouraging them to do so.
Right. Well, you don't want them to find out you're wearing silk panties with diamonds on it.
And it's the singing part that drives everybody crazy. So.
Yeah, I can see it now. I can see it now, you know. So let's talk about your social media and talk about where people find you and, of course, your podcast, where they find everything about you.
Okay, well, thanks. Yeah, of course, I've got the website, www.gvbwrites.com. Those are my initials, GVB. And the podcast is Gary Talks To, and don't forget the comma or you won't find it. It's on Spotify, Apple, and Google. Comes out every 10 days. This new YouTube launch was yesterday, and it's called Gary Talks Truth. And than on the regular things. Facebook is Gary Loves to Write, and both Twitter, or should I say X? I was thinking of calling it Twixter from now on.
Excrement.
Yeah, there you go. It's at Reader Reclusive, as same on Instagram, at Reader Reclusive. And I love to hear from people. I love people writing in, whether they're mad at me for a character or saying nice things about it. It's just nice to get a reaction, a feedback. It really does feel good.
Right. Of course, we'll put all that up on our website, so people can find you easy. And you know, you can always give out Dave's email address if you want for the people that have complaints.
That's what Al does.
Yeah, the complaint file, and then you just put his email address, and it all goes there.
I'll just put a link on my website.
And then they can click, and they can send all their hate stuff. And
thanks, Dave.
I have protesters outside my window right now. Gives them my address.
Yeah. Well, that's for the extreme cases. Yeah. That's for the mega. I give out his address. Mm. Go here. He's
the most dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. Well, anyway. Well, we appreciate you being here. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks, Alan and Dave both. I enjoy talking to you. You make this whole thing very easy. I got to say, yes. You know, just keep rolling right along. And it's very nice.
It's what I do. You know, I'm an old guy too. So
yeah,
I just didn't fly. I just talk. So anyway, well, the book is called Descent, and it's a novel based on several true stories. And the writer has been our guest, Gary V. Brill. Again, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Gary.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.